Weeble.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dawji and this is The Big Picture, broadcasting from Durban on Radio Al-Ansar and Radio Islam. The Big Picture, where we expose the subterfuge, the double dealings, the hidden agendas in the political world of Chorwans, the program in which we look behind the scenes of world events to see what conspiracies are cooked up there. And to keep things rolling, we also have a couple of laughs along the way. Now, I'm a bit cross at the moment, eh? So, one thing I want to get out of the way, right at the beginning, is a big heap of bull, a big heap of stinking bull. It's about the 24 Musallis who got arrested in Mpumalanga for making salah in congregation. Now, here's the point. The cops marched in, and one was heard to say, "Are you bigger than the president, or is Muhammad bigger than the president?" Right? And I just heard the police minister, Becky Kwele, saying that the cop, that particular cop, has been cleared of blasphemy because the cop didn't mean that Muhammad, meaning our Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Does our minister take us for fools? And what are we going to do about this? Are we going to ask him to explain which Muhammad was this cop referring to? Clearly, this is a case of blasphemy. And if we, the Muslim organizations and lawyers and so on, don't address this, then perhaps we are then fools. We just heard in the news now that a lady was arrested for using the K word, and there was another lady a year or two back who was also imprisoned for using the K word. So I thought I'll just get that one out of the way. Deal with it, people. Deal with it. Don't just let it pass. Right, so at the outset, let me make a very strong declaration, a pronouncement. Dear Bayo Beno or Buzuko, are you ready? Here is the announcement. The coronavirus is everywhere. Let me repeat that. The coronavirus is everywhere. Now, I know what you are thinking. Has A.B. Dawji been drinking the hand sanitizers? By the way, there are many, many reports that people who are desperate for booze are actually drinking the stuff because it contains over 60% of alcohol. And it makes them sick. Some even have died because it's got some other stuff in it. But some people will do anything for the dop. I can just imagine one alcoholic saying to the chap at the entrance of Checkers, "Hey, bro, give me one spray on the hand, eh? And three sprays in my mouth." Anyway, back to my astounding revelation that the coronavirus is everywhere. What I mean by that is that it's got saturation news coverage. It's everywhere, on every news channel, the whole of social media. Topic of discussion everywhere. The supermarket queue, talking over the fence to the uncle next door, is the single most important topic of discussion. And of course, no doubt about it, it's a very, very serious issue, a deadly issue. So I decided that in this period of doom and gloom, of fear and depression, I won't speak about this issue on the program today, because there is an information overload, as I said. It is a riddle. The coronavirus is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Wow. Those are the words of Churchill when he described Russia. So, many arguments and counter-arguments we've heard. how deadly it is and how deadly it's not. And so far I have received 6,842 conspiracy theories. Nostradamus predicted it in 1600 or somewhere around there. Some Indian lighty said it's going to start at a certain time and end at a certain time. The Chinese manufactured it. The Americans manufactured it. It came from an animal. No, it came from a lab. It was spread to destroy China's economy. It was spread to destroy America's economy. Some top guy said that a huge pandemic will happen soon. He said that a few years ago. Ah, and the big one is Bill Gates is behind the whole thing. And so on and on and on and on. Frankly, I stopped reading this stuff. But the lockdown, hey, that's something else, eh? You start talking to people on WhatsApp that you haven't spoken to for years. Let me say something very profound. Profound. We are repeatedly told, don't be too involved in the dunya. We've heard it many times from the mimbar, haven't we? Don't be too involved in the dunya. Concern yourself more with the akhirah. Don't involve yourself in the dunya too much. Concern yourself more with the akhirah. Well, dear listeners, I must confess that I have been almost completely absorbed with matters regarding the dunya. Yes, folks, here's a confession, right? I have been almost completely absorbed with matters regarding the dunya. Where is my next tour going to be in this dunya? We did the Middle East, we did, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Bosnia, Croatia, Uzbekistan, Russia, Vietnam, China, Spain, Morocco. So all these places have been done. And I was looking at new destinations in this dunya. Lots of calls for Pakistan and Sri Lanka, which I heard is absolutely beautiful. Maybe even a tour of Europe. And many requests for South America. So, as I said, my focus was on new destination in this wonderful dunya. But all that came crashing down. We all know that He, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is the best of planets. So everything came crashing down. It's over for some time in the future. Forget about dunya. Now the highlight of my day, as I told you, under lockdown, when the fro says, go get some dunya. So dunya is out and dunya is in. And yesterday I had to go out happily to get some pudina for the halim. That is mint. Pudina means mint. That's my occupation. Not real work, actually. Unless I start a plantation of dunya and pudina and start selling the stuff. So no money out of this. Just have to go out, get some fresh air and go and get this. Which reminds me of the maestro Muhammad Rafi. Now some of the Balis might remember this. Not his actual words, but somehow I think it fits into the discussion we are having. I think it's appropriate. Ye dunya aur pudina mere kaam ki nahi, mere kaam ki nahi. So, dear listeners, it's an essential service, I think. Yes, it's an essential service. Halim without mint and dunya is like, let's see if I can have a comparison. It's like the EFF without Malema. And speaking about politicians, dear listeners, what is the most despicable, dirty, stinking, rotten thing that a person can do? Politicians stealing food parcels meant for the poor. That, my dear people, deserves, well, let's put it this way, these churwans deserve a good dose of Islamic punishment. 500 lashes in public and maybe a hand cut off. Yes. It makes me so angry. Many of them sit on their fat backsides doing blow all, earning nice big fat salaries from you, your tax money, your hard-earned money. And then they still go out and steal what is meant for the starving masses. Ay, Kona, man. No. That is unforgivable. Of course, alhamdulillah, many of you are blessed. Many of you are blessed. Samosas, halim, curries, faluda, all kinds of goodies. A wide choice, alhamdulillah. Actually, more food on the table than before Ramadan. But I want to address one serious phenomenon to you. I don't know if it happens to you at all. But at Seri, when you have had one or two samosas and maybe a scrambled egg, which I have, and jungle oats and other stuff, and then decide afterwards, after Fajr Salah, to have a nap. Did you experience some absolutely very weird dreams? Weird, all mixed up, kachumba dreams. I had an amazing dream this morning. I met Prince Charles on top of Table Mountain. And he had this big crown on. He turned to me and whispered, "Except, bro, you got a scape on you, eh?" And I gave him a lucky strike, and we got onto a sledge pulled by reindeers, and we cruised down the mountains. Do you experience such post-Sehri dreams? I think I need to visit a psychologist or a Molana to explain what all this means. And if next time Donald Trump appears in my dream on Table Mountain, I'm going to jump right off. So, there you are, dear listeners. Nothing this week about the coronavirus. I left my Prophet of Doom hat at home. So, but I have to deal with one particularly heavy topic, which I do every year at this time. Have to do this. Palestine. At this time, 72 years ago, the Palestinians were experiencing a horror of unimaginable proportions. Experiencing ethnic cleansing, massacres, like that experienced by the Rohingyas. Do you remember them? So, here is a 2-minute history, a summation of Palestine. Please pay attention. Palestine is a tiny piece of land about the size of the Kruger National Park. Very, very small indeed. It was part of the Turkish Empire. Meaning that it was under Turkish rule, which extended all over the Middle East, what is now known as Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and of course Palestine, and stretched right across the southern part of Europe to Spain. Huge empire. Then World War I broke out in 1914, and Germany and its allies, including the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, were on one side, and Britain and France and its allies were on the other side. And Britain told the Arabs, "You must also rise up against the Turks, and that after the war is over, they will get control of all the Arab lands, Palestine, Jordan, etc." This was one of the greatest acts of treachery. And, of course, I'm simplifying it all quite a bit. But please listen very carefully. So, after the war ended and Germany and the Ottomans were defeated, France took over Syria and Britain took control of Palestine. The Jews of Europe, let's call them the Zionists, told the British long before the war ended that they wanted a homeland in Palestine. Of course, these were Jews and Palestinians living there in, they were Jews in Palestine at that time, living in peace with the Palestinians. 54,000 Jews and 600,000 Palestinians under Ottoman rule for centuries. But these Zionists, these Jews of Europe, had from the start wanted the whole of Palestine because they considered it their own holy land. So while Britain controlled Palestine from the end of the war in 1918, it allowed hundreds of thousands of Jews into Palestine so that In the following 30 years, the number of Jews increased to 600,000 Jews, or Zionists, as I like to call them, and there were 1.2 million Palestinians. 1.2 million Palestinians. The Jews there, let's call them Zionists again, were ready to fight the Palestinians and also the British to drive them out of Palestine. So it was a bloody battle. The Zionists were very well armed right from the start. They formed themselves into a militia group. Some actually joined the British Army and they got the training there. By 1947, very important, by 1947 the British announced that they were packing up and leaving because they were catching it from the Palestinians, but mainly from the Zionists. Big bomb went off at the King David Hotel and so on, and lots of British. That was the headquarters for the British. So they announced that the following year, 1948, they were going to be leaving. Then the Zionist militia group, which as I said was very well armed, from November 1947 to May 1948, I know it's about 5-6 months, they spread out all over Palestine and they attacked the Palestinians, resulting in the Palestinians leaving their homes, leaving their land. 750,000 fled to Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. More than 500 villages were destroyed and dozens of massacres were carried out. By the time, and of course you must have heard of Deir Yassin, I don't want to go into that one. I do that every year, but about 100 people, old men, women, and children were massacred at Deir Yassin. By the time the British left in May, the Zionist forces had captured 78% of Palestine. 78% of Palestine. Only three places were not captured because by then the Arab countries woke up and saw what was happening and they entered the war and captured the 22% that remained. Egypt captured the tiny little area called the Gaza Strip. Gaza Strip is very tiny. Eh? It's 47 kilometers along the coast. If you're in Durban, you must know it's from here to Park Reni, like halfway to Port Shepstone. And it's about 3 or 4 kilometers wide, 5 kilometers maximum. So it's a tiny piece of land with about 2 million Palestinians living there. The largest open-air prison in the world. So anyway, Egypt captured the tiny area called Gaza, and Jordan captured what is known as the area right next to it across the river called the West Bank, and they also managed to capture half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, where our Al-Aqsa is located. So, that was it. On the 14th of May 1948, that's, let's see, 72 years ago, I think, the Zionists declared to the world a new country called Israel on 78% of original Palestine. But as I told you, their main aim from the start was to take over the whole place. The whole place. So, they engineered a war with Egypt and Jordan and Syria in 1967. And at the end of it, defeated the Arabs and captured the three places in a war that lasted 6 days. The three places, again, to remind you, East Jerusalem, Gaza, and West Bank. And these were regarded as territories that are obtained by war, which is illegal and still regarded up to now as occupied territories. It went against the United Nations Charter, which says you can't take control of any land by war. And the United Nations passed a resolution way back in 1968 called Resolution 242, which said that Israel must get out of these areas. And Israel basically told the United Nations to footsack because it had the full support of the United States right from the time that it was founded in 1948, and whose government, by all indications, is tightly controlled by Zionist supporters in America. Very, very tightly controlled. And in Jerusalem and the West Bank, hundreds and thousands of homes have been built for Jews. Palestinian land is confiscated and homes demolished. Oppression like you can't believe. And two amazing things. The entire world does nothing about it. The United Nations is a eunuch. I want to explain what that means. It's a eunuch. It's emasculated. And worse still, every year in Israel and the United States, there are huge celebrations about the creation of the state of Israel. Imagine that. Imagine that. Celebrating the death and destruction, bloodletting, the ethnic cleansing, the massacres, the blood and tears of an entire nation, most of them crying, who are in exile, the Palestinians crying to get back to their beloved homeland. Celebrating this savagery, that, dear listeners, is incredibly bizarre. And the horror continues to this day, almost without end. I'm going to continue this discussion with the guest that we have on. No? I've been told that the guest will be on in 3 minutes' time. You must listen to this guest. Very important, well known to all of us, a former cabinet minister. So, that, dear listeners, is a very short but tragic history of Palestine and the treachery of the Arabs. And so, when the Ottoman Empire fell, we had the whole of the Middle East carved up by the British and the French. And so, we had a country called Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, ruled by a family, the Al Saud family, and who now regard themselves as a royal family. Well, they regarded themselves right at the start as a royal family. Kings and princes. And well, I heard there are 6,000 princes, but I'm not sure about that. Let me ask you this question. What is it that the whole world has been relying on for the last 100 years that is vital for the economy of every country? What is it that you don't have to manufacture, you don't have to water, you don't have to grow it, nothing at all? The answer is, of course, black gold, oil. It just pours out of the ground. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed the Muslims, the Muslim world, right there in the Middle East, with this important commodity that the whole world needs. And of course, we expected that this blessing, this oil pouring out, will make the Muslim world rich and powerful and be a great force on our planet. But instead, the Chorwans, the royal family, took firm control of the oil money and made maja. Right. So, continuing with the story of Palestine, I have a guest online, and I want to welcome former cabinet minister Ronnie Castles to Radio Islam and Radio Al-Ansar. My dear friend Ronnie, welcome to the Big Picture program.
Salam alaikum and Kareem Ramadan to you, my dear friend, and of course all your listeners. Thanks for having me on the show.
And thanks for coming on at short notice. Now, I want to discuss two things with you. And before I get to the subject of your dear friend, your dear recently departed friend, Dennis Goldberg, you launched a book recently. So in 2 or 3 minutes, tell us what this book is all about.
Okay, we'll be quick. I want to get to my big brother, Dennis. It's called Catching Tadpoles. Now, I've written 3 other books about the struggle, and my publisher said to me, you must now write a book to tell both young and old people. What was it in the young Ronnie Casrals out of a Jewish background in a very lower middle class, almost working class suburb, Yeovil, Johannesburg, born in 1938, just on the brink of the Second World War? What was it that shaped you as you grew up as a young boy and as you came to the point when you were just over 20, 21 or so, when the Sharpeville massacre took place and you took the decision to join the ANC alliance and Communist Party and then with Contra Vistis Way? By then, by the way, I was in Durban, so I know a lot about Durban, living in out of Johannesburg and back in Johannesburg. So the book is about that, and I'll just say very briefly, I was fortunate that I was born into a family who weren't political, actually. They weren't really very religious. But what they imbued in me was what the Judaic value is essentially about, and what the Islamic and Christian, the people of the book, what the key value is, and that's about peace unto others, to respect others and to treat them as you would wish them to treat you. And that gave me an empathy, especially growing up in the war years and anti-Semitism, the butchery of Jews and many other people in Europe, by the way, which made me sensitive to the suffering of people. And because my parents gave me this more universal outlook, I was shocked and highly upset as I saw the racism in the streets of Yeovil from relatives, even from neighbors, just the way they treated domestic workers, etc. My parents always said to me, don't speak to people the way these neighbors or some of our relatives do. And it talks about incidents growing up of the terrible racism in South Africa, which gave me a rebellious streak against the white authoritarianism in my school years, and then under apartheid. And I was a rebellious boy and wanted to stand up for the oppressed people. And that's why the time of Sharpeville and the terrible shootings, I looked for the ANC, and it was actually in Durban through the wonderful family, the Orenstein family, Roly Orenstein, the people's lawyer, very involved in the Congress movement with the Indian Congress, the Trade Union Congress, and ANC, of course. And I joined the Congress of Democrats with them there. The older people remember Congress of Democrats was a group, very small group of whites. We had a dozen or so members in Durban, and not more than 100 in the whole of South Africa. Dennis Goldberg was one of those people as well, but 5 years older than me and living in Cape Town, of course. So let me shift then to Dennis Goldberg. I met him in Durban just after the state of emergency following Sharpeville was lifted. And
just one second there. The book that you wrote, the story sounds extremely interesting.
Yes.
What's the name of the book again, and where is it available?
It's called Catching Tadpoles. You know those little frog creatures that
yes.
They grow into frogs, and I called it that because it was the innocence of my youth, trying to catch these little tadpoles. And when I came to write the book, searching for the memories of that youth and trying to grasp them in the recesses of my mind, of my brain, it reminded me how I tried to get hold of these tadpoles in the little pools, garden pools and so on, which is why I called it Catching Tadpoles.
But right, catching and where is it available?
You can buy it through exclusive books, through a wonderful bookstore in Durban called Arts Books. It's published by Jacana, a very lovely publishing company.
Right,
okay.
Let's move on to your dear friend Dennis Goldberg,
yes,
who just passed on recently.
Because I had mentioned that in joining the ANC Alliance, at that stage I had taken a job in Durban, and over there with my relative, Roly Orenstein, actually his wife, Jacqueline, also a banned person who had stood in the treason trial with Nelson Mandela, by the way. I learned my politics from them there, and through them I met this most wonderful group of people, from Steve Dumini of the Congress of Trade Unions, MP Naika, Dr. Monty Naika, and another one who was like a big brother to me, Billy Naya. And that's where I began to really get involved. Dennis comes to Durban from Cape Town. He's driving around the country. Little do I realize that he's basically reconnoitering the whole of South Africa. And that was for Umkhonto weSizwe, which was not yet emerging, but he was obviously recruited into it pre-December 16th, 1961. And I was recruited into it by MP Naika. We didn't talk about these things, wouldn't disclose it to Dennis, didn't even think of him being in Umkhonto weSizwe. But of course, I really took to him, and there were parallels in our backgrounds. Let me first say, he was such a warm, friendly, endearing human being. Quite remarkable. You could see he was rather different, and he was very knowledgeable, full of information, but he applied it very well. You could learn from him. He didn't have a heavy-handed way of putting the points across. Not argumentative, understanding what was actually in your mind and what you were searching to know and understand. He had that gift in speaking with anybody and everybody, and he could really win you over to the wonderful ideas that the Congress movement, and I'll say this, the Communist Party, which he had really emerged out of. He was from a Jewish family in a working class mixed race area of Cape Town, born there in 1933. The parents were in the Communist Party, hard working. His father had a small little business, cottage business. They were immigrants like my family were from Lithuania, Jewish immigrants fleeing Tsarist Russian pogroms, the xenophobic attacks on Jews as scapegoats, and were also seeking to get away from the terrible privations, the poverty, etc. So the Jews weren't, and I mean Russians under the Tsar all suffered, the Jews weren't really allowed much headway like the Indian people in our country, akin to that maybe along those lines. And he grew up, as he writes in his wonderful memoir, his autobiography, which is called The Mission, which actually is a mission to free South Africa and the world from racism. And he talks about this communist household in which people of all persuasions would come and eat and talk and debate. And these were Muslims and Christians and Jews who were from the Communist Party, quite a lot were, like Wolfie Kodesh, who was a big friend of his, Albie Sachs. And it was a wonderful atmosphere. This was during the war years, and as I had experienced the loathing with Hitler, with the racism, and the need to fight that, and he grew up, this is what initially shaped him, and it motivated him to side with the black and the brown, the majority or the minority people of color of our country who were so dominated by white supremacy, whose freedoms were so curtailed, and who suffered brutally, as we all know. He felt this as though he was one of them. He was such a big-hearted person, deep-hearted. He was filled with Ubuntu, and that is, of course, an African word, but in the Yiddish term, it's mensch, a decent, a beautiful human being. And the understanding of Ubuntu, as with this word mensch, is to embrace people, to open your heart to everybody. He was anti-Zionist. He came out of an anti-Zionist family background, as left-wing Jews were, because they saw in it, first of all, a political doctrine that emphasized as white South Africa, apartheid emphasized the superiority of the whites, and Zionism does the same thing in relation to the Jews, and the fact of viewing in, as we know, what came to be called Israel, which was Palestine, that should be exclusively for Jewish people. We see this with Netanyahu and company these days, a Jewish state, even though within Israel itself, 20% of people are mainly Muslim, some Christian, but Arab Palestinians, let alone those who are locked into and besieged in Gaza or on the West Bank under the most intolerable conditions. So it was a family that had that particular stance. And this is what brought Dennis into the liberation movement. He joined the Communist Party. He was actually recruited by Bram Fischer in 1957. He was locked up together with his mother during the state of emergency in 1960. After that, he visited Durban, as I say. And then, as the story is well known, Dennis Goldberg, at the age of 30, was arrested with the senior leadership of the ANC and Communist Party at Rivonia. They faced the sentence of death, along with Mandela, who had been arrested before them. As we well know, death was expected. And it's a wonderful story that Dennis, when the death sentence wasn't passed, I think apartheid was too afraid to go to that length, and it was life imprisonment. As we know, South Africa, life imprisonment then was your entire life. His mother was in the court. She was hard of hearing, and she was elderly, and she didn't know what it was. He turned to her beaming, "Life, mother, life is beautiful." And he served 22 years before he was released. We know a few years later they began releasing Govan Mbeki and others from Robben Island, Walter Sisulu and family, after Kathrada, Ahmed Kathrada, another great friend of Dennis Goldberg's, Mandela himself. And in the years that he was freed, he lived in London with his wife and young family, two young children. They had fled South Africa and were in exile there, so he hadn't seen his wife and his kids for ages. This is why Dennis didn't come back to live in South Africa immediately after 1994, because his wife and the younger kids were now growing up. They had a life in Britain. They had their jobs, their careers, and he just didn't want to tear himself away from the family. So for some years, he came and he went back and forth to South Africa. The ANC asked him to set up fundraising in Britain. He became one of their most impressive speakers internationally, such an articulate man, such a clear message. And he was such a creative person that he said to the ANC, "You know, you want me to go around asking people to provide funds, we'll do that, but let's set up our own business." The ANC didn't think any business could make money. He set up a merchandise business out of London, which sold ANC regalia and stuff, and it made money for the ANC. He set up another organization called Community Heart, which operates to this day, and that raised books and education equipment for not just South African children and schools, but for the whole of Southern Africa. His wife died in 2001, and his daughter, tragically, still youngish, also died a year later. I enticed Dennis to come back to South Africa, and I said, "We've got a job waiting for you. I've spoken to President Mbeki. He wants you here." "And what would that be, Ronnie?" he asked. I said, "Dennis, I'm Minister of Water Affairs and Forestry. You are a civil engineer. We need the likes of you to help us in our delivery of clean water to the villages, to the informal settlements, to all the people of South Africa. We need to set up sanitation. We need to improve the sanitation conditions." And you know, Kada Asmal had started such work in water affairs, if you recall, from 1994. Mm. I took over from him in 1999. And We made that department work and function. We had a wonderful rollout program of water services, water delivery, developing toilets at schools and in the rural areas. And incidentally, we had a Wash Your Hands campaign, an education campaign called Wash. We had Nelson Mandela washing his hands, and this was like a commercial on TV, the need to be to wash your hands and keep cholera, which was the threat of the time, especially in KZN, to keep it at a distance if you cleaned your hand. The tragedy, and Dennis saw this, and I saw this, we discussed it so often, because as is well known with Kathrada, both of them, when Zuma had messed things up through the theft and the robbery of institutions in this country and the rundown of the municipalities where the corruption also developed amongst the mayors at local, from provincial right up to the national level. The department had been basically reduced in its capacity and efficiency because the Zumaites just put in place the cronies who do nothing, whether it was about the health service, whether it was about tax collection, you know, the whole problem of the Pravin Gordhan, whether it was in water, whether it was in transport. We know that story. Dennis Kathrada took the issue up and were critical of Jacob Zuma and spoke truth to power. I did as well. We had a difference of opinion because he felt, along with Kathrada, Arnold Kathrada, that you could reform the ANC and renew it from inside. And hopefully that can happen with Cyril Ramaphosa. They're now attempting to change things. I, perhaps more rebellious, had a difference, and we did debate this out. And I said, no, you talk from inside the tent. I'll help by being more critical, because if you're still within the ANC, the limits are there in terms of how far you can go. We had very fine discussion and debate on that. I'm bringing this out to remind people that Dennis Goldberg, that Stephen Dlamini, that Walter Sisulu, that MP Naika, that Ahmed Kathrada, that Rowley Arenstein, that Monty Naika, that all these people, the golden age of our struggle, didn't serve for themselves, for their self-interest, to feather their own nest, for glory, for greed, for power and position. They served for Ubuntu. They were big in heart and pure in heart, and this golden is so illustrative of that. Let me tell you, when
we just, Ronnie, we just run out of time, and I think we'll have to leave it there.
Well, there's my tribute to a great and glorious and wonderful South African, Dennis Goldberg. Thank you.
Well, there you are, folks. A wonderful account of the friendship between Ronnie Castles and Dennis Goldberg, an anti-apartheid icon of the struggle and an anti-Zionist activist. A rich life indeed. Ronnie Castles, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Take care and all the best.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Right, well, that's the end of the big picture. Lots more to cover, but we've just run out of time. So this is A.B. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.